In the early years of the so-called Bologna process, which was launched in 1999 with the Bologna Declaration by European ministers of higher education, the primary interest lay with the introduction of the bachelor and master cycles in higher education institutions of all the participating countries in Europe. One of the official reasons for launching the Bologna process was the heterogeneous organization of European higher education, as it used to be structured in a very different way in all European countries. Not only were there almost as many titles of degrees as there were European countries, there were also considerable differences in workload between similar studies in different countries. In order to strengthen the transnational mobility of students, teachers, researchers, and academic workers throughout Europe, a basic common structure for higher education study courses in Europe seemed to be needed that would allow for the transnational comparability, acceptability, and validity of university degrees. It would allow academics with a degree obtained in Sweden or Finland to apply for a job in France. It would allow students with a Spanish bachelor's degree to continue their master's studies in the Netherlands. It would allow people with an Italian master's degree to apply for a doctoral grant in the UK. It was even said that transnational mobility would become an integral part of the study path of a European study, according to the slogan Bachelor at Home, Master Abroad. After having obtained a bachelor's degree in one's home country, the typical European student would leave her home country for at least 1 year in order to obtain her master's degree in another country. Through its philosophy of enhanced mobility, the Bologna process presented itself as a tool for improving international relations and strengthening intercultural understanding. In its choice for the titles Bachelor and Master as the names of the first two cycles of university studies throughout Europe, continental European higher education was obviously also conforming itself to the existing structure of Anglo-American higher education. European policymakers must have thought that the best way for Europe to become the world's largest knowledge economy in 1910, as the so-called Lisbon strategy demands, was to imitate some of the features of its main competitor. With the German sociologist Richard Munch, and against the self-promoting narrative of mobility and multiculturalism of the Bologna process, we hold the idea that the Bologna process is launched mainly to serve capitalist interests rather than intrinsic academic or scientific needs. However, we also believe that it is possible to redirect the Bologna process away from capitalist interest. If Karl Marx could say that capitalism was better than feudalism, if Antonio Negri and Michael Hart, in their Worldwide Communist bestseller published by Harvard University Press, could say that empire is better than the nation state, then we can say that Bologna's academic capitalism, as Richard Munch calls it, is better than Europe's former academic feudalism. By saying, in a way that is intentionally as provocative as Marx's plea for capitalism, that Bologna's academic capitalism is better than the pre-Bologna academic feudalism, we see Bologna as a machine that destroys idiosyncratic national educational structures that do not necessarily serve the interest neither of students nor of teachers and researchers. It is true that the Bologna process establishes a kind of academic empire constituted by a growing transnational network of academic institutions. Nevertheless, the worst way to defeat Bologna is to allow it to try to establish itself. The transnational multitude of students, teachers, and researchers, which since a few years find themselves in similar situations, and which the Bologna newspeak has provided with a whole vocabulary with which they can share the experiences beyond national boundaries, may at one point or another redirect the capitalist orientation of the Bologna process. As a matter of fact, the pressure of transnational students' bodies has already been effective in pushing European higher education policymakers to adopt a more social implementation of the whole process. With the meeting of the Bologna follow-up group in Berlin in 2003, the third cycle leading to the doctorate became a priority of European higher education policy. With the growing focus of the Bologna process on the third cycle, also emerged the idea of a doctorate in the arts. It seemed logical if artistic study courses too had to conform to the structure of bachelor and master cycles, It was necessary to create a third cycle of artistic study courses in order to obtain the doctorate in the arts. Indeed, as of 2003, in most European countries, the doctorate or PhD in the arts did not yet exist. In the years that followed, academic institutions in many European countries decided to establish the doctorate in the arts. Meanwhile, the doctorate in the arts has become the subject of heated discussions. First of all, there is the existential question many people ask. Why should there be a doctorate in the arts rather than nothing? Weren't we happy without it? It is no secret that many people see neither the socioeconomic necessity nor the artistic relevance of a doctorate in the arts. There is fierce opposition to it from people within high arts education, universities and the arts field, at least insofar as it still makes sense to draw a clear-cut distinction between higher arts education, universities and the arts. Secondly, once you accept the possibility of a doctorate in the arts, there is the formal question what form of the doctorate in the arts should take. Indeed, a defense of the doctorate in the arts is only an institutional condition of possibility for the defense of a doctorate in the arts. A doctorate in the arts will always be defended according to a certain concept of the doctorate in the arts, laying out in rules that have previously been defended within the responsible university or faculty board or council. As a matter of fact, the latter kind of defense might turn out to be as exhausting as the defense of a doctorate as such. It will continue to demand a good deal of a struggle in order to establish that the doctorate in the arts meets artistic rather than merely academic requirements and expectations. So first of all, there is the existential question whether there should be a doctorate in the arts or PhD in the arts at all. Against the voices who oppose the doctorate in the arts as such, we would like to defend the idea of a doctorate in the arts. Our belief in the legitimacy of the doctorate in the arts as a third cycle in higher arts education, analogous to third cycles of scientific study courses, is based on our understanding of the artist as a researcher in his or her own right. In a very basic sense, to portray the artist as a researcher is one way, among others, to problematize a still widespread popular understanding of art as merely irreflexive, spontaneous, intuitive, etc. This shouldn't lead us to think that intuition or spontaneity are not constitutive of research, whether scientific or artistic. Rather, it should remind us of the fact that decisive moments of intuition that may lead to scientific discoveries or artistic creations only occur within a long horizon of time spent on careful reflection, patient investigation, rigorous experimentation. There is no doubt that flashes of insight, moments of vision, or whatever one may call them, occasionally may lead to a dazzling acceleration of artistic or scientific processes. It is understandable that the spectacular character of these moments captures the imagination of outsiders more than the boring rituals of the artistic or scientific profession that they may interrupt. But there is no doubt either that a popular fixation on these moments, how constitutive and important they may be, has led to a considerably distorted portrait of the artist as well of the scientist in popular imagination. It may well be that, as far as the artist is concerned, the hegemony of this popular misconception explains why, until some years ago, the doctorate in the arts seemed something foolish. Indeed, a long horizon of time, which is what the doctorate is in its abstraction, seemed incompatible with the idea of art as something irreflexive, spontaneous, intuitive, etc. Even today, it is a real political challenge to give artists time. Most people seem to believe that to give artists time can't mean anything else but to allow them to spend even more time in the bar. Our understanding of the artist as a researcher is not a definition we try to impose on the artist. Rather, it is the way many artists during the last 50 years have been describing themselves either implicitly or explicitly. During the last 5 decades, artists have been describing their work as involving an investigation into as a reader on, even to the point where they argued that the investigation of the research process as such was produced in the form of performances, exhibitions, or artworks. For those who know, and we all know, how severely researchers today are under pressure to produce output, it may be quite ironic to be reminded of the fact that the self-description of artists as researchers usually was accompanied by a strong opposition against tendencies to evaluate the usefulness of artistic funding through output evaluation. It seems as if artists must have thought that the image of the researcher would be helpful in order to explain that art is primarily about a process of reflection, of interrogation, of thinking, not about its eventual output. The self-description of the artist as researcher may have been nurtured by a romantic image of the researcher who, entirely divested of any material interest, has all the time of the world in order to struggle with problems or questions, just for the sake of intellectual struggle and the little intrinsic pleasures that come with it. Of course, as a researcher or as someone who knows about the actual unromantic state of research today, one could take quite some cynical pleasure in the unmasking of the poor naivete of the artist who still believes that researchers are primarily driven by an intrinsic interest in the questions and problems they are dealing with. However, one could also adopt a very different attitude, and that would be to be thankful that the artist, through their naive, neoliberal self-description as researchers, have in fact been trying to save the idea of the autonomous researcher. In the same vein, the institution of the doctorate in the arts could be welcomed and applauded as an incredible chance to reinstall at academies and universities a space of autonomous reflection, which seems under threat, if not already to have been lost, in the science departments of many universities, where scientists are supposed to subscribe to the idea that they are only good scientists if they are able to develop an idea that can be valorized and sold as a product on the market, ideally by a spin-off firms, which will be happy to welcome the scientists as a well-earning member of its executive board. In our view, the doctorate in the arts is to be defended as a space of autonomy within an institution whose autonomy is severely under threat. To portray the artist as a researcher is nothing more, but above all, also nothing less than a plea to give the artist the unproductive time needed in order to be able to become productive in an innovative way. Innovative production can only emerge within a long horizon of time. Secondly, there is the formal question what form the doctorate in the arts should have. Although academics involved in the establishment of the rules for the doctorate in the arts did pay attention to the demand that the new doctorate should respect the specificity of an artistic education, to the extent that they accepted the idea that artists present a portfolio of their work as a doctorate, most of them fiercely defended the idea that a doctorate in the arts would be inconceivable without a written supplement. As a result, the format of the new doctorate mostly requires both an artistic portfolio and a written supplement. The insistence of academics on the obligation to produce a written supplement appears to demonstrate a lack of confidence either in the capacity of the arts to speak in a meaningful, complex, and critical way in the medium of their choosing, or in their own capacity to make sound judgments on the meaning, complexity, and criticality of artistic output as such. What might happen now, and what is in fact already happening, is that because it complies with the long-standing format of the doctorate, juries of a doctorate in the arts will base their assessments primarily on a reading of the written supplement, as if it were the doctorate itself, at the same time being tempted to consider the artistic portfolio as merely its supplementary illustration. As a consequence, what happened is academically trained art historians with a hobby as an amateur photographer have been able to obtain a doctorate in the arts, merely because they are academically trained enough to produce an academically valid textual supplement to the portfolio of very doubtful photographic work that the jury refuses to judge in itself, because that would be all too subjective. Well, at the same time, a world-class musician got in quite some formal trouble concerning his doctorate in the arts, because a textual supplement to the 200 CDs of his work as a performer and interpreter that constituted his portfolio didn't refer in an academically proper way to existing musicological literature. Contrary to this kind of aberrations, the evaluation of a doctorate in the arts should focus on the capacity of the doctoral student to speak in the medium of his or her choice. And if this medium is film or video or painting or sculpture or sound, or if the doctoral student wants to mix media, it will obviously require from a jury ways of reading, interpretation and discussion other than those required by an academic text. To impose a medium on the artist is to fail to recognize the artist as an artist. An artist who wants to obtain a doctorate in the art should be given the academic freedom to choose his or her own medium. Even then, it would still be possible for he or she that he or she chooses text as we ordinarily understand it as the most appropriate medium for his or her artistic purposes. Lately, some of those who defend the idea that a doctorate in the arts should not only consist of an artistic portfolio but also of a textual supplement have been trying to save their thesis by claiming that this textual supplement should, of course, not necessarily take an academic form. As we are speaking of a doctorate in the arts, we should adopt a pluralistic attitude towards the demand of a text as a supplement to the artistic portfolio as part of the doctorate in the arts, and could easily imagine textual supplements that take a very artistic form. As long as it looks like text, it could be a literary text, a diary, maybe even a theater play or a series of poems. Artists who would want to defend a doctorate in the arts should not be frightened by the requirement to write an academic text. It could also be an artistic text. While trying to save the requirement of the textual supplement, its defenders are in fact giving proof that the requirement has always been nothing but a form of bureaucratic conformism. At first, we were told that the demand for a textual supplement was prompted by fear that it would be impossible to judge an artistic portfolio, not because it is a portfolio, but because it is artistic. Therefore, a textual supplement was needed, which could be judged more easily, because it would be more articulate. But if now the supplement itself also becomes artistic, the problem is why one thinks that it will be more easy to judge an artistic textual supplement than an artistic portfolio. The idea seems to be that artistic output can only be adequately judged if there is something formal, text, academic or not, that supplements it. So we are led to believe that we need some form of text in order to decipher the artistic work of the artist who wants to become a doctor in the arts, in order to know whether that work deserves a doctorate in the arts at all. Defenders of the textual supplement as necessary part of the format of the doctorate in the arts like to think of themselves as people who take a more intellectual approach to the arts. Strangely enough, these people cherish a notion of text that is completely uninformed by the major intellectual reflections on text. The major contribution to the philosophy of text in the last five decades has been, and still is, the philosophy of Jacques Derrida. And it seems to me that the defenders of the textual supplement as necessary part of the doctorate in the arts haven't understood one word of his philosophy. It is quite interesting to know that Derrida's philosophy of text was in fact born out of a pragmatic reflection on how to write a doctoral thesis. As a matter of fact, Derrida's struggle with this question began in Massachusetts. Indeed, in 1956-57, a young French philosopher who just had earned his agrégation at the École Normale Supérieure in Paris, for the first time in his life, came to the United States and spent a year in Cambridge with a grant to study at Harvard University. Mentioning always briefly Jacques Derrida's year in Massachusetts, many of his biographers attribute him with a strange-sounding status of a special auditor at Harvard University. Harvard University may indeed have a firm, firm-like reputation that got, fortunately only to a limited extent, deconstructed by last year's financial crisis, but Derrida did not, when he came to check its balances, which is what an auditor, and especially a special one, was used to do. As Geoffrey Bennington wrote in Derrida Bays, Derrida came to Massachusetts to check the microfilm archives of Husserl's unpublished manuscripts. At least that was his pretext. At Harvard University, where according to its website, the status of a special auditor is not known, Derrida was in fact a special student, which, as a matter of fact, is nothing special. It means that he was a non-graduate student, not enrolled for a degree. The consistent mentioning in all Derrida's Anglophone biographies of his status as a special auditor at Harvard University in 1957 is, ironical as it may sound, most likely due to a transatlantic translation error. In French institutions of higher education, a special student is sometimes called an auditeur. The term derives from the Latin audire, which means to listen. Auditeurs are special students or students that are special in the sense that they got the authorization to attend lectures at the university in order to be able to listen to them, but not to pass exams on them. Implicitly, the term auditeur also says that it is undesirable that the special students ask questions, because that would mean they would not only listen but also speak. The auditeur is not allowed to collect credits in order to obtain a degree, and therefore is not supposed to produce output of any kind. The auditeur is the student as the mere receptor, if not the receptacle of input. Ideally, the auditeur doesn't even produce the zero degree of output, which would be a question. In Boston, however, Derrida is not just an auditeur, he's a special auditor. He's an auditor who asks questions, if only to himself. The most urgent question for him at the time was how to write a doctoral thesis in philosophy. Through his reading of James Joyce and his study of Edmund Husserl in Massachusetts, the French special auditor Jacques Derrida tried to fix the theme, but also the form, of a doctoral dissertation he planned to write once back home. In France, a special student is also called an étudiant libre, which is what I was, not me, but Edith Lesage, when in 1988 and 1990 I studied in Paris at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales, attending the courses of Jacques Derrida, while trying to fix the theme of the doctoral dissertation I wanted to write, which eventually would become a deconstructionist reading of the philosophy of another genius who, as a very young man, would arrive in Cambridge, Massachusetts, only 1 year after Derrida left, Saul Kripke. In my doctoral thesis, Derrida and Kripke, who both share an albeit very different philosophical interest in proper names, would have the meeting they missed in the 50s in Boston. Kripke, who as a student at Harvard taught at graduate courses at MIT, would leave Cambridge with a bachelor's degree in mathematics, apparently never caring to obtain a doctor's degree, nevertheless becoming of the United States' most famous philosophy professors. Derrida, to the contrary, did care to obtain a doctor's degree, but struggled tremendously with all the philosophical questions that came with the project of writing a doctoral dissertation. For Derrida, as a philosopher, it was inconceivable to write a philosophical thesis without ever asking the philosophical question, what is writing? For Derrida, the project of writing a doctor thesis led him to an impressive intellectual struggle with the question of writing. While Saul Aaron Kripke became one of the most extravagant academics in our time, of publish or perish, in that he published very little and did not even write his most famous book, which is called Naming and Necessity, which was based on transcripts by students and colleagues of partly improvised lectures. Jacques-Élie Derrida, in his own way, equally resisted traditional academic standards and expectations concerning writing. Only in 1980, at age 50, Jacques Derrida obtained the so-called doctorat d'état, a special type of doctorate, which until 1985 it was possible to obtain in France, not on the basis of a conventional doctoral thesis, but on the basis of one's work. Indeed, for his doctorat d'état, Derrida presented and defended, through a long oral examination by a jury, 3 books, which all deal in one way or another with the question of writing. In a sense, one can say that Derrida's doctorate merely consisted of a philosophical portfolio without an academic supplement. One of the main reasons for this is that Derrida simply couldn't accept that a traditional doctorate in the philosophy wasn't supposed to reflect, in the way it was written, a fundamental thinking on the question of writing. Derrida's philosophy of writing, as he developed in the books that constituted the portfolio which he finally presented as his doctorate, is very helpful in order to discuss the sense or nonsense of the format of the doctorate in the arts. The idea that an artistic portfolio should be supplemented with a text in order to obtain a meaning which can be discussed intersubjectively misses the point that the artistic portfolio itself is always already a text. This is a consequence of the famous Derridean dictum that says, "Il n'y a pas de hors texte," there is no outside to text. A firmly established and quite ridiculous misunderstanding of his philosophy, that there is nothing but text, is to say that Derrida would have claimed that there is no outside world. Derrida's idea that there is nothing but text means that the outside world is itself text too. Not text is everything, but everything is text. In an interview at the end of a book in which he discusses, among others, Austin's and John Searle's philosophy of language, Derrida said, angry at the way in which some American philosophers had been trying to ridicule his philosophy as an absurd form of escepticism. Quote, "I wanted to recall that the concept of text I propose is limited neither to the graphic, nor to the book, nor even to discourse, or even less to the semantic, representational, symbolic, ideal, or ideological sphere. What I call text implies all the structures called real, economic, historical, socio-institutional, in short, all possible reference. Another way of recalling once again that there is nothing outside the text. It does mean that every reference, all reality, has the structure of a differential trace, and that one cannot refer to this real except in an interpretive experience. The Latin neither yields meaning nor assumes it, except in a movement of differential referring." End of quote. So a portfolio which is a selection of artworks is definitely always already text in itself. As a matter of fact, a portfolio will most likely be a presentation and or a documentation of artworks, rather than the works itself, which means that it is, in its presentation or documentation, already differentially mediating and reflecting the artworks, and that text, in the narrow sense of the word, is even already part of it. The artistic portfolio as a documenting and representing form already speaks of the work, rather than that it would be the work itself. At the same time, it is also work done by the artist, an artistic work that represents and documents other artistic work by the artist. The portfolio itself has to be qualified as text, both in the expanded as in the narrow sense of the term. If the text which supplements the artistic portfolio doesn't need to be academic in the case of the doctorate in the arts, it becomes difficult to understand the requirement that the artistic text, that is the artistic portfolio, should be supplemented with a text which may be an artistic one. It seems as if one intends to establish a structural lack in the doctorate in the arts. It will never be adequate. It will never be enough. In fact, this seems indeed to be the feeling of world-famous artists with an astonishing portfolio who would like to obtain the doctorate in the arts when they are told that in order to do that, they still have to write a text, just because the jury also wants something to read about the work, which in itself would be too difficult to judge. Derrida's expanded concept of text implies the need for an expanded notion of reading, as well as of an expanded notion of writing. As Derrida wrote in Of Grammatology, quote, "And thus we say writing for all that gives rise to an inscription in general, whether it is literal or not, and even if what it distributes in a space is alien to the order of the voice, cinematography, choreography, of course, but also pictorial, musical, sculptural writing." End of quote. Here, Derrida's examples of writing are still all artistic. Later, Derrida would expand the concept of writing even more. But the first and self-evident move in his expansion of the concept of writing was to include all art forms. Films, dance, music, painting, sculpture, all of them are in themselves forms of writing. Art is writing and is therefore to be read. Reading, however, is not just about decoding the meaning of signs. Reading has to come to terms with the fact that it will never be possible to determine once and for all the meaning of the world. The demand for a textual supplement to the artistic portfolio may be explained by fear for the constitutive abysmal character of meaning. Instead of asking for an explanatory supplement, juries should confront themselves with their fear and have the courage to try to read what is already written. The argument that I hold against a textual supplement should not be understood as the idea that the artwork in itself is already full of meaning, but rather that there is no way to remedy with the abysmal structure of meaning which the artwork signifies. It is the demand for the supplement itself which suggests that there might be a way to fill the gap. If an artist considers himself or herself as a researcher, thereby he or she most likely wants to share something about the way in which one artistic production usually develops. Artistic research can involve many different things: avidly reading about a specific subject matter, randomly visiting exhibitions and confronting oneself with other artistic positions, trying out the visual, acoustic or haptic impressions of different materials, or even ritually going to the flea market in search of nothing in particular, as Eran Chef once beautifully and convincingly described one aspect of his practice of artistic research. What all these different practices have in common is the need of time. Time to think, time to see, time to waste. As time is money, time is never given to anyone for free, and certainly not to the artist. As a consequence, everybody is under extreme pressure to explain why he or she needs so much time for such and such. Therefore, one cannot exclude that part of the actual discourse on artistic research is rhetoric used, needed, or devised in order to convince funding authorities, which are known to subscribe to the dogma of research and development, that the artistic practice is to be funded is in fact also research. If 3% of the gross national product of European member states should be invested in research, then here is a brilliant opportunity for European member states to comply to their commitment. Investment in artistic research. In a few European countries, a part of the research budget is now specifically allocated to artistic research. This is a great victory for art academies in these countries because it allows them to become major sites of artistic production and to establish themselves more self-consciously within the arts field, not on its doorstep. Of course, the danger is that European member states, with difficulties to comply with this 3% rule, will rename a part of their budget for cultural research in order to artificially attain the norm, rather than augment their cultural budget with another budget within the research budget specifically allocated to artistic research. Artists and art institutions who mainly depend on public funding should be aware that public authorities are under great pressure to legitimate why certain institutions or individuals get public funding. All in all, the discourse on artistic research seems an adequate way in order to explain why artists need time and thus money in order to create. Artistic creation is not just about materials that one needs to buy or spaces one needs to rent. It is also about time needed to dedicate oneself to reflection, to study, to thinking. As a matter of fact, the notion of artistic research is quite subversive for a field that God uses to pay high prices for artworks, completely independent from the amount of labor time involved in it. For me, the notion of artistic research is also about the recognition of the artist as a worker, as somebody who works so many hours, so many days, and whom I want to get some money for all the things she does. For me, the notion of artistic research is not at all about an attempt to conform the arts to the sciences, to become more methodological, or to become more discursive. It is about the recognition of art as a form of cognitive labor and about a wage struggle for artists who no longer accept that they work for an exhibition, that they get production money for works, but almost never get any fee for all the work they have done in order to prepare that exhibition. All the time, artists are told to invest in their work, to speculate on future value of their work. Artists are supposed to learn how to become their own shareholders. The discourse which presents artists as researchers should be an empowering discourse which values the artist as a worker, which contributes to the recognition of the need to pay artistic labor time.